Thank you, Mohammed. This is an incredibly pretentious title. And to be perfectly honest, I didn't stage myself to do this. We actually asked one of our African participants to do this lecture, but during time constraints, he was not able to do it. So I basically am a substitute. So I just want to make clear that this was not some effort to stage myself to do this kind of big review or revisit of migration theories. Nevertheless, I'm happy to do it. But it's perhaps good to make clear from the outset what the aim is of this mini-lecture. It's not so much to give a full review of migration theories, because there are very good reviews out there, like the article by Messi et al. From 1993, and some other reviews that are well known in the literature, and there's no time for it either. So that's not the objective of this mini-lecture. It is indeed, as Mohammed just explained, it's really more about showing why there is a need for theory in order to better understand migration. And I will try to illustrate it by reviewing some of what I call common assumptions on what people think is the nature and what drives migration processes. But if we look a bit closer, we actually have to question those assumptions. And I hope with this to convince you that theory is important. And it's been said yesterday by Oliver as well, that we often think about theory as something boring. Like when we write a thesis, we always have to write this first chapter, and we now need some theory section. Or as Mohammed said, it can be a kind of alibi kind of exercise that we have to review some theories, and then finally we can write our thesis and our empirical case. Maybe more or less forget about it. But theory is everywhere. That's another thing I would like to emphasize. And even if we don't think we are doing theory, we are doing theory. I would like to disagree with Lauren. He kind of provoked me yesterday, that we do not sufficiently understand the nature of drivers of migration processes. It might be true that most people migrate because they have the expectation to improve their well-being, but I don't think that's a theory, and that doesn't really help us to understand current-day migration. And I also think that migration theories are weakly developed, biased, and largely cut off from general social theory. What do I mean by that? I think migration theory, as far as theory is explicit, is very much a kind of applied science. A theory is often used, Oliver has written about that, in a quite haphazard way. People pick a theory, want to test it, or they observe an empirical phenomenon, and then they pick kind of the theory that fits best with the empirical phenomenon they're studying. Migration theory is also biased. And that's been discussed yesterday. It has a strong receiving country focus. And I think the second big bias is a focus more on outcomes of migration than actually on what drives migration. And a third problem is this disconnect from larger theories about social change and development. Again, migration is very much an applied science, compartmentalized, kind of cut off from broader social scientific debates, which is really a pity. And it's been said yesterday as well that a lot of migration research agendas, and I would say particularly so in the African context, are largely set by control-focused agendas of governments and international organizations, rather than by theoretical questions. This is obviously partly linked to lack of funding to do independent academic research. So you can't blame the researchers for that personally, to a large extent, but I think it's important to be more aware of the way we research migration. We tend to ask our questions are very much influenced by state perspectives, and in particular, receiving state perspectives. Hence, for instance, the emphasis on smuggling, trafficking, transit migration, irregular migration, perceived problems of integration, which very much reflect the state agendas. And I think this reveals the need really to reconceptualize migration and to improve that connection with broader social and economic change rather than a problem to be solved, because that's often the way migration research questions are formulated to start with. And on the theoretical level, that shows the need to increase this embedding of migration theory, which has very much been something cut off from broader debates on globalization, social and economic change and development. And to try to understand how migration is part and parcel, is an integral part of global social and economic transformation, rather than a cause or a consequence. You know, it's fundamentally embedded in those processes. And there I totally agree with Laura. But perhaps my kind of angle is different here, because I'm a migration geek, and Lauren is probably not. So my starting point is a bit different, but I do totally agree that in order to advance our understanding of migration, or more generally of social and economic change, we need to embed the study of migration in broader perspectives on social and economic transformation and development. I would like to emphasize, even those here who don't think they are doing theory, they do theory, just the way they categorize migration. Categories are theoretical by definition, because theory is very much about generalization and simplification in order to create schemes through which we can understand migration. Now, categorizing, in its essence, is an effort to reduce, to generalize. So even if we don't think we're doing theory, we're doing theory just by the apparatus of words and terms we're using in order to describe what we are seeing. But these categories are particularly problematic. And this really shows how state perspectives have been dominant in migration studies, in the quite uncritical way many migration researchers tend to use these categories. Tend to copy literally categories as used in legal frameworks in policy discussions, as defined by states, as social categories. And that is very problematic. Now, the most obvious example is internal and international migration. Now, there might be many reasons to use this distinction, because states are important and states do partly shape migration processes. So in a legal sense, it does make sense to make some distinction between internal and international migration. But it needs to be questioned to what extent this is relevant from a social perspective. So a migrant within China, moving thousands of kilometers from a non-Han Chinese background to Han China on the eastern Chinese coast, which may be subject to migration restrictions, internal migration restrictions, might cross greater legal and social and cultural barriers than a migrant between, let's say, the United Kingdom and the United States, which is defined as an international migrant. But it doesn't necessarily mean you face the same obstacles and you cross the same gradients and difference. I mean, even a better example is probably intra-European Union migration, which is not subject to any control whatsoever. Another interesting is immigration and emigration. I'm struck sometimes by the debate, it's particularly the Francophone debates in Africa, that African researchers often talk about immigration, so which reveals a perspective from the receiving state. So the way we call migration already, we talk about every emigration is also an immigration. So if we talk about immigration, we unconsciously adopt the receiving state perspective. Now, if we say emigration, we unconsciously adopt a sending country perspective. And so these categories cannot always be avoided, but they're potentially problematic. And perhaps migration is in that sense a more neutral term. Terms which really annoy me a lot, but are very often used, are home and host country. Because they're purely ideological. They reflect an attitude that the home country is basically the country where you're supposed to go back to. This is where you belong. It's very essentializing. And the host country reveals the image of the benefactor society, which is perhaps something that might be appropriate in some cases when we talk about refugee migration. But even in that case, I would question that. But what I just want to try to say is it's very ideologically, it's a very ideological term, host and home country. And we might even question origin and destination country for other reasons, but I think here it is very clear how ideologically laden these terms actually are. Legal and illegal migration is another hotly debated term in the literature. Because, yes, a migrant might be illegal in legal terms, but it's often equated with illicit migration, whereas we know, and I think many researchers of African migration know, who've done fieldwork, that what states do see as illegal migration can be seen as perfectly licit, socially speaking, in migrant origin societies, where migrating illegally is not sanctioned socially, and might be seen as totally legitimate social behavior. Again, these reflect state perspectives. The same for temporary and permanent migration. It again reflects attempts by states to define who are those migrants. Are they getting a temporary visa or a permanent residence permit? Now, of course, migrants also allude to the temporariness or permanentness of their migration, but they often don't match the labels that have been received by states. And then we have the whole range of categories about alleged motivations of migrants. Labor migrants, student migrants, retirement migrants, family migrants, lifestyle migrants. And many of these categories reflect, particularly the labor, student, and family migrants, reflect state category, legal categories that states have used to try to put migrants in different drawers. And from a state perspective, this is perfectly legitimate, so I'm not contesting that. The problem is when social scientists uncritically adopt these categories to try to put migrants into boxes. And this filters through directly in methodologies. So many questionnaires ask migrants, what was your primary motive to migrate? And then they can tick boxes like labor, family, study, for instance. But they can usually simplify the mixed motives migrants might have to migrate. And it's well known that many family migrants end up working, that many labor migrants end up not working, that many students end up working, and that many students and labor migrants end up marrying. So we have many cross-cutting categories here. And the same, of course, for refugee migrants. So this is also problematic, particularly the way migration researchers tend to use these categories very uncritically, just in the way they, for instance, construct questionnaires and interview item lists. Now, last but not least, the distinction between forced and voluntary migration, which again is legitimate from a state perspective in order to implement refugee law. So I'm not contesting that. But again, from a social scientific point of view, this is a problematic dichotomy. Because it sets up an idea of that you have either completely voluntary migrants or you have migrants who are completely driven by force. Whereas it is, I think, sufficiently clear from research that most migrants migrate within a continuum of a certain degree of constraints and a certain degree of agency they can self-exert. And this can usually vary, but the idea that we're talking about a kind of dichotomy is problematic. So I just tried to show that theory is implicitly embedded in the way we just talk about migration, we do research about migration, even if we never even talk explicitly about migration. And I think one of the points that has also been addressed yesterday is trying to find this right level of generalization. Because I think when we look at these push-pull and standard models and of migration, it is almost like stating the obvious. So to say that most people migrate in an attempt to improve their well-being, or that differences in income or wealth or freedoms have an effect on migration, is not a theoretical statement. It's a truism. It doesn't actually help us to understand how migration is structured and how most migrants do not move from the poorest to the wealthiest societies, to give just one example. It doesn't really help us. Or to say that networks facilitate migration. I'll come back to that a bit later. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. And their function might change over time. So it's a nice general statement, but again, it doesn't really help us to understand the diversity of migration. And the issue here is to explain real-world migration as we see it, which is on the one hand complex and diverse, which in my view has been overemphasized in the literature, because any social process is messy, complex, and not similar to atoms moving. So the powers of physics. But I would argue that migration, nevertheless, is a very strongly patterned and structured process. It's not random at all. Just the way we see that migrants move from particular villages in Senegal or Morocco or in South Africa to particular destinations, either within countries or abroad, already reveals it is not as chaotic as it's often suggested. And yes, that we can theorize much more than is often suggested. This is the only slide that gives a very brief review of migration theories. Just to flag, we can perhaps make one big division in migration theories. And we can regroup all migration theories perhaps under two big paradigms in social theory. On the one hand, the functionalist paradigm, basically assuming that all forces, social forces, tend towards equilibrium. And here we can group together the kind of static push-pull frameworks, neoclassical theories, and perhaps also the new economics of labor migration. And then on the other hand, we have the structuralist paradigms, where we can put neo-Marxist theory, dependency theory, center-periphery theory, and world-centered systems theory. And they conceptualize migration into entirely different ways. Whereas the functionalist paradigm basically looks at migration as the outcome of calculations made by individuals about opportunities in places X, Y, and Z, and predict that migrants will move to those places which basically offer best opportunities. The structuralist paradigm doesn't attribute much role to individuals making such decisions, and much more look at structural factors constraining migrants' choice and leading to migration being an exploitative social process rather than a process that leads to the betterment of migrants and actually increases gaps between rich and poor societies. I'm going to stop here consciously. There is whole literature out there that further reviews these theories. We can perhaps make another division, which is between theories on so-called root causes and theories on the continuation of migration. So the root causes are these big neoclassical or neo-Marxist models that try to explain why do people migrate on a kind of general level. Whereas theories on continuation of migration, particularly networks and migration systems theory, try to explain why migration, once started, tends to gain its own momentum and tends to become self-perpetuating. Now, the problem is that these theories between root causes, these macro causes impinging on migration, and these theories that try to show how migration as a process itself tends to reinforce itself, and how migrants themselves play an active role in continuing this process. But there's a very weak connection between these theories, and this shows a limited ability to incorporate what we call structure, so these conditional factors, and agency in migration theories. And this is very important in order to better understand migration behavior. For instance, the example I gave, the common distinction between forced and voluntary migration is simplifying migrant behavior, because migrants generally face to a certain level constraints that limit their behavior, but also most migrants have at least at some level some agency. And I would even argue for most refugee migrants there is some level of agency, although very constrained, they can exert. For instance, even if people are forced to leave, for instance, in choosing potential destinations to go to. But also to explain not only stability in migration systems, but also how they change over time. We need both structure and agency. So the issue is to understand, why do we need theory? Yes, we need theory because to try to understand how migration is a process which is in full part of broader social and economic transformation processes, that often as development. Second, also has its own internal self-sustaining, but sometimes also self-undermining dynamics, but also affects these broader transformation processes in its own right. So yes, migration is conditioned by all sorts of conditions, but migration has its own impact on those initial conditions that set migration. And it's exactly this embedding of migration in broader social and economic theory that is essential here, to try to explain how migration is a pattern process, but also to try to be much more critical in distinguishing individual motivations to migrate from conditional factors, conditional drivers of migration, both in origin and destination societies. And by reading some of the papers, I still observed there was some confusion between motives of individual migrants and causes of migration on a macro level, which might not always be the same. Now, I just want to illustrate and hope to clarify my argument by just reviewing some what I call conventional wisdoms on migration. And I would argue they're all theoretical statements to pick up what Ollie said yesterday, that theory is about statements about relations between concepts. And all of these five wisdoms do relate different concepts to migration. The first of all is poverty is the main cause of south-north migration. The second is development will reduce migration, which kind of follows from the first one. The third one is that globalization has led to mass migration. We have seen a huge increase in migration, and this is always linked, or often linked, to globalization. The fourth one is that climate change will lead to mass migration. And the fifth one is that migrant networks facilitate migration. These are all very common statements in policy and in social scientific research on migration. But I would like to argue, and to some of you this is perhaps not a surprise, but perhaps to others it is, that these are based on questionable theoretical models and assumptions on what actually drives migration. And here I would like to emphasize that yes, we think we know what drives migration. Yes, on a very general level we know that. But as soon as we start to look further and actually try to explore these idées reçues, these received ideas on migration, we need to question them. And this also reveals the need for better theory and more critical thinking about migration. Now, to start with these images of boats arriving, either Spanish pateras arriving on the southern Spanish coast, or pirogues arriving on the Canary Island coasts, have really evoked this image of a misery migration, particularly in the press and in policy. This has been very prevalent, particularly in connection to African migration, which also seems to be different from other types of migration, in being a migration driven by misery. Poverty, civil war, and even climate change have recently been mentioned as reasons why Africans massively leave the African continent. Now, I'm not going to discuss this perception that this is a massive migration, which is by all accounts falsified, but I'm rather focusing on this causes idea, because it's a very appealing idea which has often been mentioned in debates, political debates, for instance, on how to address this problem. I would argue that this reasoning reflects on a theoretical level push-pull and very simplistic versions of neoclassical perspective, which say, okay, migrants move because they want to better themselves, so they move from poor to rich. This seems to make sense. And then the argument we need to develop so we have less migrants seems to make a lot of sense. But of course, a lot of you have done research on this already, and this is not a surprise. Most south-north migrants are not among the poorest. Why? Most reasons that have been mentioned are the fact that migrants need money, basically, to migrate. But I think there are many other factors as well. It's not just the capabilities in terms of having the money, but also to have the knowledge, to have the connections, to be able to reach people in destination countries to help you to migrate. But I would add to that aspirations. And this is linked to media, education, and with the overall increase in education across the globe, but also in Africa, you can easily argue that it's not just capabilities to migrate, that capabilities are necessary to migrate, but also you need a certain level of aspiration. So your horizons have to broaden, your aspirations have to increase before you actually aspire to migrate in the first place. And the fact of having been to school often spurs migration, which is another reason to believe that development, broadly speaking, so not just economic development, but also increases in knowledge, education, do spur migration. And typically, across along development processes, however we define them, these capabilities and aspirations typically increase as people get access to education, resources, financial resources, and information. This is just a graph of some African countries which shows the number of citizens of those countries living in wealthy OECD countries. The blue bars represent the absolute numbers of migrants. So for instance, according to official figures, 300,000 Nigerians are living in wealthy OECD countries and 1.6 million Moroccan migrants. I'm talking about migrants here, not citizens, not second or third generation, live in wealthy OECD countries. The red bars show the percentage of the population this represents of the origin country. Now, just look at Nigeria and Morocco. Nigeria being a population giant, with an estimated population size, I'm always a bit confused about the figures, like on the 130 million inhabitants, something like that, has actually a very small percentage of their population living in wealthy countries. Whereas a country like Morocco has a much higher percentage. The same goes for Algeria and Tunisia. Now, it's tempting to link this to distance, and certainly distance plays a role here. But there's another factor, which is the level of socioeconomic development that certainly also plays a role here. And there's other evidence for that, which I'm going to show a little bit later. And this brings us immediately to the second debate. This idea, which is again based on push-pull models and neoclassical models, that development will reduce migration. And this underpins and justifies so much policy discourse and so much, actually, policies that we mentioned yesterday. Co-development policies and migration development policies are implicitly or explicitly based on the assumption that development, either through aid, trade, or remittances or circular migration, will in the end lead to less migration. That's the bottom line. It's also the bottom line behind this idea that was raised after the migration crisis at the Canary Islands at the Euro-African Summit for a Marshall Plan for Africa. They're very questionable in view of historical evidence that wealthy societies are intrinsically more migratory and mobile than poor societies. And this is a graph simply summarizing this theory, which has also been called migration transition theory, that generally social and economic development leads to increased capacities and aspirations of people to migrate, and generally leads, initially at least, to an increase in international migration from countries rather than a decrease, and that is the big paradox. And that's the kind of hump-shaped pattern that you can see here. Now, this has been described for historical migrations that Oliver referred to yesterday already, between the Europe and the Americas, where it were the relatively wealthy European countries that migrated first to the Americas, and it were the relatively poorer countries in Eastern and Southern Europe that followed suit. But that has been described for many other historical migrations. But also if we look at current world migration, we can still detect the same pattern. And this is from a paper I've recently written using a global database of migration stocks. Now what this figure shows are the five, I mean I categorized all the countries in the world basically along five categories, from very poor to very wealthy based on their GDP per capita levels. Then I calculated the total number of emigrants from those countries as a percentage of the total population. These are the blue bars. What this graph shows and suggests is that it is not so much the poorer societies that have the highest numbers in relative numbers, so percentages of international migrants, but rather the countries which have a kind of average, middle range level of economic development. And it's only when countries become wealthier beyond that kind of average level, the numbers of emigrants tend to decrease, and countries tend to become net immigration countries. But it again suggests and seems to corroborate the historical evidence that this pattern still holds, basically. This is a similar exercise with the human development scores, because it's often been criticized that income doesn't adequately reflect development. So this includes all sorts of other factors, like life expectancies and education. But basically, it reveals exactly the same pattern. So it's not surprising that the countries like Morocco, Tunisia, and Algeria have very high numbers of emigrants. And this cannot only be explained by proximity. And even if we look within West Africa, it's countries like Senegal and Ghana, which are relatively wealthy compared to some other countries in West Africa, that have higher numbers of international migrants to Europe than other West African countries. Again, this is not a coincidence, I believe. So development might lead to more migration, so that this is another reason to revisit our certainties, to take up a point by Mohamed Berian. The other idea, has globalization led to mass migration? This is also a big consensus. We are living in an age of unprecedented migration. So the idea of the integration of regional economies, societies, cultures, through communication and trade, so globalization, transport and communication, the increase of incomes globally, but at the same time, growing inequalities in income have spurred world migration. That's the idea. The incentives have increased, possibilities have increased, so more and more people are migrating. And at the same time, people get better educated, they need to travel more in order to find, they need to migrate more in order to match their skills to certain jobs. And labor markets are getting more and more complex, so hence we see a bigger drive for migration even within wealthy societies. And this graph of the total world population of migrants since 1960s seems to reflect this idea. There has been more than doubling, tripling actually, of the numbers of migrants international. But this is the same graph, so the blue bar is the same, the blue line is the same as this bar, oh no, the pink line, sorry. But the blue line is total world population. And here you can clearly see that world population has increased equally rapidly as the total global migration stock. So you don't need to be a mathematician to do a next calculation, which is to calculate the total number of migrants as a percentage of the total world population. And here we see a remarkable pattern of stability, particularly if we know that the increase between 1980 and 1990 has largely been the result of the split up of the Soviet Empire and some other countries like Yugoslavia and Czechoslovakia, which have transformed many formerly internal migrants, for instance Russians in Ukraine and Ukrainians in Russia, into international migrants. Another factor, did you know that the number of countries between 1960 and 2010 has increased by threefold? So there were about 60 countries in 1960, and now we have about 180 countries. Which make you even think, because you would have expected a much bigger increase, because there are many more borders now in the world that should actually make people into international migrants, which makes even more questionable the idea that there's been a global relative increase in migration. I would also say this also compels us to rethink theories about globalization and migration, because the figures simply don't match what we think. And we need to rethink how globalization has impinged onto migration. Because yes, it's true, on the one hand, the classic argument is transport technology, infrastructure has facilitated movements. But perhaps globalization also has had some other effects that have counteracted this migration increasing effect. Because if you think about technology, yes, on the one hand, transport and communication, but on the other hand, it has also facilitated trade and outsourcing. It has made possible people to commute, so not to migrate in order to work, to work on distance, so teleworking and telemeeting, which has taken away some need for people to migrate. And with outsourcing, industries have literally moved to countries which formerly tended to be origin countries of guest workers, for instance, and industries have partly moved to those countries. The Mexican maquiladoras is a very good example of that. But we also see in Africa more and more outsourcing of services and industries by European or American companies. And on the broad term, on the long term, we can even say that technological processes actually enabled populations to settle. Scientific and technological process has enabled people to settle, not to move. Just the whole sedentarization, the historical move towards sedentarization, the invention of agriculture, the Neolithic Revolution, I'm going a long time back, but this is the first, these are very early advances in knowledge, and in a way in science as well, in the ability of human beings to impose their will on the world, have actually increased their ability to settle. So we come from a much more mobile past than we used to think. And this, Kelvin has talked about the myth of the immobile peasant in that sense. Now, last factor is perhaps state formation, the increasing concern for security, and restrictive migration policies. Perhaps they also explain why we haven't seen this massive increase in migration. This is not the final word on this. This is just to show that there are some pretty compelling other arguments which seem to partly undermine what we think is true, which is globalization has led to a mass increase in global migration. And perhaps we should say that rather an increase in volume, that there has been a change in the nature. But not just the nature, but also the way we tend to perceive migration. The lenses through which we look at migration have fundamentally changed. On the one hand, we did see a reversal of global migration, which means whereas the Europeans used to move out to colonize, discover, conquest, and occupy other parts of the world, particularly in Europe, it's been a pretty brusque change that now Europe has become a net receiver of migrants and is confronted to influxes of migrants. So Europe had witnessed a huge increase in immigration, not the world, but Europe has witnessed a huge increase in migration from outside Europe to Europe. And since many discourses on migration are Eurocentric, it is not illogical that Europeans think we live in an age of unprecedented migration, whereas other peoples in the world might not share that perception. And perhaps it's also true that we have seen a diversification of migration. So the increased geographical scope, so migrants can, it's more easy to travel larger distances. It's not necessarily